When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Well, the UK is close to a trade deal with Australia, so Tim Tams are going to replace penguins and the UK will be better for it. But the UK farmers don't think they're going to do well out of it. What about hormone-fed Australian beef? And what about the economic arguments? Well, we visit Ricardo, look at the law of diminishing marginal returns and ask, is the whole idea a little flawed? Or when it comes to agriculture, was Ricardo right? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Okay, so the UK has in principle agreed, Steve, to this first post-Brexit trade deal. I mean, there have been others, but they have been simple replacements to the trade deal that was already in place with the EU. So they just changed EU to UK, like Japan, for example. But this is the first one the UK has beaten the EU to, because actually the EU is trying to negotiate with Australia as well. So this is another of those, is free trade a good thing moments, Steve? This one, we're told, will eventually increase UK GDP by as much as, now wait for it, 0.02%. It's going to save UK households as much as £34 million a year. That is 50 pence per person. That is 1 pence a week we will save as a result of this trade deal. So, I mean, first off, there's no such thing as a free trade deal, is there? Because they always come with many conditions attached. And, of course, they have to have conditions attached because there is no level playing field. Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, it's just free trade. Well, actually, there's an interesting question. If we did just have free trade, if we had no tariffs, we had open movement of goods, what would happen, do you think? Would it be a good thing or a bad thing?
You'd see a fair bit. One of the reasons for conditions on trade deals is normally, you know, individual sectors and we're trying to protect their interests and not be completely exposed to the trade. But a lot of it is also standards. So if you let anybody ship anything they like to this country, then we'd be getting, as other countries, like Australia would be doing it, of course, whereas other countries started decarbonising their vehicle fleet, you'd get cheap secondhand cars and they'd be imported by the billion into Australia and increase the pollution levels there, which doesn't seem to worry Australian politicians, but that would be the outcome. So it's one of the reasons you have conditions to maintain acceptable standards for commodities, and then that's a large part of the trade deals.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because there is a very different approach to standards between the UK and Australia. So you wonder how this is going to work out, because a lot of it is touching on agriculture, which is, you know, generally one of those areas that you need to protect. Because, first of all, you need obviously you need to ensure you've got food security. So you need to keep growing what you've got. But the interesting thing in the UK as well is, and this is where economics doesn't stack up too well, UK farming is such a significant part of the landscape. So it's part of the country's heritage. It's part of the environment. Economics is not very good at factoring in things like that, is it?
Well, this is where economics began in many ways, because formed the current pattern of the English countryside was the enclosure movements. And these began when you started having capitalist farming taking over the previous feudal farming. And with the feudal farming system, the basic story was that there was, I think it was called a feudal mense, which was titularly owned by the king and occupied by a lord. And the lord, so the lord held the land in behalf of the king, and then the lord would then be required to dole out a certain amount of land to his peasants to work on, and then there'd be land owned in communal sense to some extent, but also land owned by the lord themselves. And the peasants would produce what they needed for subsistence effectively on their own plots of land, and then they would work collectively on the lord's land, both for the lord's need for food and also for any trade that the lord would do with that food. And When you think about the what that meant in terms of the pattern of the land holdings, though one of the I think it was a statute back in about the 15th or 14th century. Within these were the lords started to be rapacious as they behaved towards the peasants, and then there'd be peasant revolts. There were plenty of times peasants decided to be genuinely revolting rather than just in the cartoon caricature. And as one of the laws was passed by one of the kings of England was that the minimum amount of land that a peasant could be given on a feudal mense for their own use was 4 acres. Now, 4 acres as English land is a pretty substantial, it's quite a lot. It means you can grow enough for your family. And the usual story was that looking at the, and again, I'm not an expert on this, I'm relating what other people have researched and I've read. A normal life for a feudal peasant involved 2 days of working for every 1 day partying. You'd work 2 days and take one off, and that was the usual pattern. So you had small holdings everywhere. You had a large holding next to a feudal estate, and then you had the next feudal estate and the next feudal estate and so on. And the real beginning of capitalism was the realization that there was money to be made in food, and rather than just doing it for maintaining the feudal system, you were now having merchants and feudal landlords turning into agricultural holdings companies rather than the feudal system, and they do the enclosure. So they basically enclose the land which the peasants will push the peasants off. And that's what formed the working class in the early days of England's industrialization. You had all these people who were driven off the land, homeless. Originally they were landless laborers, and then as the industrial process grew, they moved into work in the burgeoning factories of 19th century, late 18th and early 19th century England, and that was the growth of the original growth of capitalism. So what we've got is the remnants of the enclosure movement, with a tiny touch of what the feudal estates were about. It's a very different pattern to what it was when it was actually in some ways better for the peasants than they got under capitalism. But it's certainly that pattern has become part of the overall landscape of the country. And people, the English garden, they love that landscape. And the French have a similar attitude, but the French are actually much better hanging on to small-scale sort of operations. Peasant capitalist holdings.
Yeah. So 70% of the land in the UK is agriculture. So here's the interesting thing, though. If you just look at it from the point of view of hard economics, it's 70% of the land. It only provides 1.5% of the jobs and accounts for just 0.6% of GDP. So if you were looking at the efficient land use, you probably wouldn't farm. You'd be saying, well, okay, or you would be farming in a different way to try and increase that efficiency. But, isn't this where we get into this, the whole argument, and I know how much you love the idea of the Ricardian argument that if we've got a limited amount of farmland, or we can't get any more, then importing from overseas is going to extend that farmland in effect because it reduces the impact of diminishing marginal returns. So, I mean, that would be the argument, wouldn't it, for an Australian trade agreement, for example, that if we needed to produce more because we've got a growing population and we're constrained by local production, then we're going to reach a stage where extra demand is going to push prices up. That's the idea. I know your favourite thing of diminishing marginal returns because we're going to run out of land, and therefore we get over that problem. That is the base argument, isn't it, for free trade. You get over that problem of diminishing marginal returns because you can just extend your land in effect because you buy from overseas.
Yeah, well, and that's a good way to put it too, because that's when it comes to land, there is some sense that the idea of diminishing marginal productivity, because Ricardo's original frame of reference was his own theory of rent, yep. Which said that initially when farming began, you would farm the best land and there would be no rent payable. You'd pay rent on the differential as you expand the population and you've got to use less good land, then that means that people who've got the good quality land have a bargaining chip of those with the poorer quality land, and with that bargaining chip they can demand rent. So that was Ricardo's fundamental theory of rent. That's a large part of what turns up in Henry George's work as well. And that is actually saying what you've got is diminishing productivity of one of the inputs. and the essential input, of course, to agriculture being land. So that's why way in which the idea of diminishing marginal productivity makes sense. What the neoclassicals did to make a mockery of it was to apply that to the idea of inputs to production of a fixed, in their assumption, a fixed productivity. So they see each unskilled worker is just as productive as the other unskilled worker. But you're adding more and more unskilled workers to the same stock of machines, which of course is not possible, but that's never stopped neoclassical economics. And you're adding more of these fixed quality workers to the same number of machines. That means you get a diminishing amount of output out of each additional worker you add. And that's their explanation for diminishing marginal productivity.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Which is completely wrong, but that's of course on the basis of their overall extension of this idea about international trade in agriculture having benefits because you sell from your high marginal productivity industries and buy their high and you get a trade off in terms of. They specialise in what they're good at. You specialise in what you're good at, and overall, the physical amount produced is increased. And in the case of land, there's half an argument that makes a bit of sense. Well, there's zero argument in favour of the manufacturing side of things because the whole idea that you can add a variable number of workers to a particular machine is garbage.
Yeah.
In fact, I know one case where that happens and there's much lower productivity and the firm is trying to investigate, A, why the Chinese use 16 workers when the machine only needs 9 and why they're managing to produce 9 million units per year when the machine is designed to produce 14.
And the land argument obviously doesn't apply at all once you get outside agriculture because you can just build a new factory because, as I said, 70% of the land at the moment is used for agriculture, and if you can get more out of it from manufacturing, then you would, so long as you're happy to destroy the countryside. So,
that's more an Australian thing than a UK thing.
Well, there we are, you see. Well, I mean, in lots of ways, standards have gone in Australia, haven't they? They're less worried about...
Standards? Standards?
Well, yeah, so,
what
I mean...
What's the amount of alcohol per beer?
Yeah, well, there's got a minimum on that, have they?
That's true. Yeah.
It's got to be over 4%, probably.
Let's call it English piss, yeah.
So let's look at those standards, though, because, I mean, there's hormone-fed beef, for example. There's obviously very large farms. It would be, and this is the big concern, isn't it, from farmers in the UK, are they going to get flooded with cheaper imports from Australia? And you look at it and you think, well, almost certainly you would, even though, I mean, so on two counts, the danger to what it could do to the UK farm industry. Well, three counts, really, what that then means for food security. And thirdly, what it's doing for the planet, shipping stuff all the way around the planet to try and get here.
And that's what, to me, I mean, this is the Achilles heel that neoclassical economics assumes away, which is that it costs physical resources and money, and it generates pollution to ship goods from one location to another. And we're going into a future where we're going to be forced, whether we want it or not, to put less load on the biosphere by pumping less carbon dioxide and doing less damage to the environment than we already do. And it may well be that those, when you factor in those costs, they overwhelm any potential price advantage out of a trade deal that's going to be shipping bananas from Australia to the UK. Mm. At the same time, you've got to ship them. There are some commodities, and this is one of the things which makes a small amount of sense in trade deals. There are some goods which simply can't be produced in one of the two countries, and I think bananas are a good choice for England.
Yeah, but beef.
But they could buy them from Egypt, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Somewhere closer, for sure. Yeah, look. I know, on the other side, of course, we still are getting tariff-free imports from the EU. Maybe that means that the Australian farmers won't be able to compete. So maybe it's dead in the water unless we upset the EU so much that they start to put tariffs on. But I mean, Ricardo's theory presumably would say that look, if we were able to get it cheaper from Australia and from the EU, then if they can use their land more effectively, or they've just got more of it, so they can produce food cheaper, then we should let them do that. And I'm not sure, what do we do? Do we close our farms and then use that land for something that we are better at? So do we set up Silicon Valley? So Silicon Valley, for example, in the States, that could be used as farmland, but instead it's being used as campuses for the tech industry. So same land, much greater benefit to the economy. Maybe we should be doing more of that.
Well, but it comes down to what are the gains from trade? And as I've said, one of the big hole in the whole idea of gains from trade is the belief that you can easily reallocate resources from one industry to another inside a country. Because the theory starts off by assuming, in fact, that there is no international transfer of labor or capital. Mm. Now, that's garbage. We know that that's massively contradicted by the real world, for a start, by the fact that a large part of production is done by multinational corporations. Ireland's output of Microsoft Windows is pretty impressive, so far as I understand. And what that means is the sales of Microsoft Windows from Ireland to the rest of the world don't mean the profits from that accrue to Ireland. They get shipped back electronically to America and line Bill Gates's pockets and others rather than that of the Irish. And therefore, you can't say anymore whether the physical increase in output that the theory argues happens actually ends up with an income benefit to the people in that country. So, right from the outset, the thing is shoddy. But as I've said, the main weakness throughout is the belief that you can move machinery from one sector to another without losing any productivity. Now, Ricardo made this easy to do by simply ignoring, in that little passage where he focuses on the example of Portugal and England exporting cloth and wine to each other, he completely glosses over the need for machines to produce any output. And I might add that obviously has been improved over time. So, for example, Paul Krugman got his Nobel Prize in economics for doing an economic geography model of the gains from trade, with some limitations to that, where he assumed that all output was produced using labour alone. Give me a break.
Perhaps he's living in caveman
times.
Perhaps he's living in caveman times. He's doing everything with hand tools, and we really haven't progressed very far from that.
Well, that sounds like New York to me, the Tribeca district at least. It's nonsense. The main gains from anything are gains from investment, not gains from trade. And one of the fun things, I've got to go back and find the original article because it's hard to find some of this older stuff material before, but Harry Johnson was one of the absolute proponents of the neoclassical theory of free trade. And a lot of the theories which are still used today originate in Harry Johnson's work, as well as a couple of, I think they were Swedish economists, Heckscher and Olin. But Johnson tried to make his case one day by trying to estimate in theory, and using economic data of course as well, what the absolute gains to trade were to be if you went from the global situation at the time back in the 1950s, when tariffs were often of the order of 40% and 50%, to the point where they were zero and everybody benefited from free trade. And what he found was that using his own theory and his own parameters for his own models, I think he ended up with the benefits of the going from high tariff situation of the 50s to complete free trade was about 0.5% or 1% of GDP. And he concluded that this was equivalent to the normal gains from technological progress over about 6 months.
Mm.
So the entire focus on trade deals rather than on investment is just nonsense.
Well, it's interesting
by economic theory.
Yeah, because tariffs aren't that large now, are they? I mean, the World Trade Organization tariff on agricultural products is 14%. For meat products, is 19%. So you'd be thinking, well, okay, in effect, we could be trading with a 14% impost with anyone anywhere in the world if we wanted to. We don't need to because we've got free trade with the EU. But if there was a more efficient thing we could do with that land that we're using for agriculture, we would have already done it, wouldn't we? But the fact is we haven't, because there isn't, because there aren't enough people to do. And as you're saying, you know, there's not the investment there.
Yeah. And like the because you have a, I mean, economic theory is a world of numbers with implicit numbers with no explicit numbers written down. So when you do a typical neoclassical course in economics, you'll have at some stage, I'll show you what's called the Edgeworth box diagram. And that's how they show the idea of gains from trade. That was the initial way of modeling it. And what you would have is you draw one country with what they call, I think, if you remember, I haven't looked for a long time, so I might put my foot in my mouth here, but they'd show the indifference curves, the preferences that this particular society had, say between guns and butter. So you got guns on the vertical axis, butter on the horizontal axis, and you draw a curve which shows the combination of butter and guns that makes that particular society equally happy. Obviously, America liked lots of guns and not very much butter, and England likes lots of butter and not quite so many guns.
Yeah.
And then
that's why we solve disputes by chucking butter at each other.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the butter wars. Remember, you did have the pudding hurler of was it Battersea?
The great Battersea pudding.
The Battersea pudding hurler.
We're going back to the goons now, aren't we? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but you then get a price line coming out of the. You then get a budget constraint coming out of it, which was the actual, you know, the relative price of butter versus guns would then determine whereabouts on that. Which indifference curve, which was the highest one you reached, you know, with the largest number of guns and butter, and that would be the price ratio for that country. And then you do exactly the same thing with the other country, but flip it upside down, so you form a box. And then what you have is two price lines of two different slopes reflecting both the preferences of the country and their capacity for production. And the idea is that you would then have trade occurring where the indifference curves were tangential to each other. The idea being that particularly when you draw these curves, you know, the infinite number of curves going out showing, you know, the higher curve shows a higher amount of utility from the guns and butters you're consuming. And where the two curves are tangential, that's the new price. And that new relative price gives you the a trading advantage for producers in both countries. And now, all that
based
stuff
on
is
just
done
two
with
products.
So then you two products, yeah.
So then you got to do.
Numbers,
right? Okay, yeah. And then it's a bit overly simplistic as well. I mean, then you got to do. Got to do it for butter and nail clippers, and then nail clippers and guns, and then guns to socks, and then socks to butter.
Peas. We can turn beans into peas. And now we're going to look at the time bandits. All this stuff is done without numbers. When you look at it, that's an advantage. You know, the slope is different. I can see the logical argument, blah, blah, blah. Mm. And then the empirical stuff, if you actually, even within the theory's confines, as I said, when Johnson tried to work out what the numbers might be, they were the order of, you know, 1-3 to 6 months, total from total autarky to total specialization. Gives you about 3 to 6 months worth of annual economic growth. But the thing is that let's not worry about the numerical side. The model looks beautiful, and let's put the model into practice. And this is where you get all this obsession with free trade deals out of economists. And also it suits politicians because they get to hold hands with each other in foreign locations.
And it looks like they're doing stuff. Exactly.
Show off respective shopping trolleys, like that ridiculous photograph of Boris and Scummo. Oh, is it Scummo? It's not Scummo, is it? It's
ScoMo.
It's Simo, isn't it? ScoMo. Yeah, yeah. Holding hands, how nice.
I think you might have been right.
Were they touching elbows? I can't remember.
Exactly. It's impossible, isn't it? I wonder whether it's going to come off, because it is impossible on a number of levels. You can't have a free trade when you've got different standards. So last year, the government introduced the Agriculture Bill in the UK, which is sort of like the next step after all the support that was provided to farmers by the EU. So it stops direct payments to farmers based on their land, and instead it bases it on the subsidy is going to be based on output, but also meeting environmental standards. Most of it seems at the discretion of the Secretary of State, because everything since since Brexit is falling in the hands of ministers rather than government at large. But you can't have subsidies like this if you're engaged in free trade, can you? So that places the danger that you are, if you put everyone on level footing, you go to the lowest common standard. That's basically where you head.
And Australia rules.
It does.
And that is...
Yeah.
And that's the trouble. That's why these things are so complicated, and also why you've ended up having free trade being used to constrain the freedom of governments to make laws for their own countries. So you know, it's been Frankenstein's monster for in industrial systems and agricultural systems around the world, because all of a sudden all the attempts they make to control their own environment for the benefit of everybody. I mean, we don't want DDT in your drinking water, but if it's now quite possible for a company to sue a country because it prevents it selling DDT to that country. So, you know, we're caught up in a hellhole where we've actually basically, in the idea of free trade, we've handed over control to corporates who can just do what you know, can lobby for whatever they want for their own benefit, you know, which in neoclassical terms, again, is letting corporations have power to use against the rest of us, which is not supposed to happen in the textbook.
Yeah. Well, and this free trade deal can be agreed another deal that can be agreed with it falls into the minister's remit. It doesn't have to go to Parliament, irrespective of the impact it can have on the UK. This is one, you know, nice little thing that was in the Brexit agreement, the Brexit law that was passed, that almost all of these decisions fall in the hands of the relevant minister. And so one of those decisions that's been made clearly is, because the big difference between farming in the UK and the farming in Australia is hormone-injected beef. It's legal in Australia, New Zealand and the US and Canada and South Africa and Japan, but not in the EU or the UK. So with being out of the EU, then presumably we are dropping that requirement, which means if we drop that requirement and start doing it here, then we wouldn't be able to export to Europe, because, of course, they've still got that that requirement. So it just makes it a very uneven playing field. I mean, it's an absolute nightmare, isn't it? And yet, you know, the argument from Australia is, well, you don't have to worry about hormone-fed beef, because they reckon 77 kilos of beef, that's how much you'd have to eat in one sitting to get the same estrogen hormone that's found in one egg. That's their argument. I mean, they may be right, but I mean, there's got to be a reason why we've not had hormone injected beef in the UK, and now we're going to have it, presumably because we're going to accept it from Australia. And if we're, you know, and it's a big efficiency for Australia to have it, so we can't compete without it.
Yeah, and therefore, again, it's a lowest common denominator effect.
Mm, yeah. Let me tell you about hormones, actually, in beef, because I did do a bit of research on this. In South Africa, they say it can take 3 years for bovines to reach slaughter weight. With hormones, you can slaughter them at 18 to 24 months old. So it's not quite doubling the production, but that is a major efficiency, isn't it? Which, you know, the broader question is, of course, how much red meat should we be eating and whether it's good for the planet. But the introduction of hormones really just changes the whole dynamic of the industry.
Yeah, and it changes our biology as well, which is one of the reasons that. And what about antibiotics? Antibiotic injection also legal in Australia and banned in the UK?
I'm not sure on that, yeah. But, I mean, it all falls into...
That is where a large part of antibiotic resistance has come from over time, of course. Excessive use of antibiotics for enabling higher agricultural output. But that's what's generated the superbugs we're now coping with in our medical system, one of the things that has.
So is a better way, rather than going to individual countries and having these individual agreements, I mean, are we better off just with WTO rules across the board? Do we say, well, okay, we all need to protect we've all got the same issue, that we've got different standards in agriculture, we need to protect our own industries because it's part of our livelihood, part of our landscape, but also we need it for food security. I mean, should we just be forgetting about the idea of free trade and saying, well, let's all universally agree what is the optimum tariff that should be placed on various sectors and not have free trade? I mean, you know, should we actually be saying, yes, let's go about and, you know, these photo opportunities could be the Prime Minister going to various countries, tearing up free trade agreements that currently exist.
No, I don't think they're going to continue going off and signing them, because it makes it look like they're doing something useful. But the really useful thing would be promoting investment back at home. Mm. And that is one reason that countries have, like Japan and Korea and China and Germany at one point or two, have successfully industrialized using tariff policies that force their manufacturers to produce domestically and then also force them to industrialize and grow at a faster rate. This includes America. One of I've yet to read it fully. I've before I met Michael Hudson, that he wrote this as his PhD thesis, but he called it America's protectionist takeoff. He said the industrial development of the America began when America instituted tariffs to stop the importing of British goods and particularly British manufacturing equipment and forced the local development of it. And that was a major part of why America industrialized so rapidly and so successfully. So it's all an argument about whether this actually promotes growth over time. And the neoclassical thing is, let's just specialize, let's improve what we've got now, and that will automagically, as one of my computer programmer friends used to say, automagically increase the rate of investment. No, it doesn't. It quite possibly reduces the rate of investment.
Yeah, and yet we still have all those people alive in the 80s who were the fanboys and girls for, more boys, I suspect, for Margaret Thatcher, who, you know, you still meet at dinner parties from time to time, who say, yes, she was doing exactly the right thing by closing down industries because they were inefficient. And if you can buy them cheaper from overseas, then you should, you know, talking about iron and steel. The thing is, of course, in the 80s, Britain closed down its iron and steel industry to import subsidized iron and steel from overseas, a lot of it coming from Germany. So that argument doesn't really stack up. But if it wasn't subsidized from overseas, you know, have they got a point?
No, they have a minor point, because there's some things which you can't produce domestically. I mean, I'll use bananas as an example for the UK. You could probably produce bananas in the Netherlands using greenhouses, knowing how innovative the Netherlands agriculture is. But not in the fields of the UK. And there's also sometimes technological developments occur, such as, for example, you know, Tesla cars, and you can't produce those locally because you simply don't have the technology to do it in the first place. So there are some things which, yes, have to be procured internationally. But if you look at what actually causes growth over time, it's developing new industries out of combining old ones, and that puts a premium on a diversified industrial structure, not a specialized one. So if we could reframe this stuff in terms of what actually works, which is a diversified industrial structure, and then bring it down to products which can't be produced in some countries and therefore you have to have trade, then you have a more realistic framing of trade's role in the economy overall. But the way it's put forward by neoclassicals, it's the be-all and end-all, it's the absolute beginning, the absolute foundation of everything else, and what you get ultimately, everything including industrial policy, is made subservient to trade policy, and you therefore quite frequently get a lower level of investment, a lower level of innovation coming out of it. For bugger all gains, even when you work it out with neoclassical logic.
Well, now the photo opportunity's passed. For my, for what it's worth, I believe that this trade agreement with Australia won't happen. I think it's gonna falter because of this lowering of standards that the British population is probably not going to be prepared to put up with. But we'll see. Look, next time, another topic that we have touched on from time to time, but we can explore in a bit more detail. Unions. Is the economy missing out on not having powerful unions, and what effect is it having? So we'll do that next week. Good to talk, Steve.
Good day, mate. Okay, good.
So that's it. Phil Dobby and Steve Keane back next week for another podcast. Thanks for listening. See you then. If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.